After a two-week hiatus, it's good to be back. Today, we're going to begin a 10-part series on learning to love the Lord and our neighbor with all our soul. This series is part of a broader goal this year to learn to love with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Jesus says that learning to love God and our neighbor with these four parts of us are the two greatest commandments. There's no better way to love better than to try and figure out how to best fulfill the first and second commandments. Yet, as we begin this series on the soul, I have a problem. I know what my heart is, I know what my mind is, and I know what it means to use my strength. But what on earth is my soul? I'm not entirely sure what a soul is, and I suspect most of us couldn't clearly describe it either. I think I have one. I even thought I had one before I realized God told me I had one. And I suspect I'm not alone. Most people that I talk to believe that they have a soul. We tell people things like, "Have you no soul?" when we believe they're being unkind or merciless. Romantics talk about finding their soul's mate, and when you're struggling to know your place in this world, we talk about doing some soul searching. Those who make moral compromises, well, they're accused of selling their souls. And when a beautiful song or lyric hits just right, we talk about it reaching our souls. Well, for crying out loud, we even have soul food and soul music. When the food is so good that you feel like it didn't just feed your belly, it fed something deeper. We talk about the soul like we all understand it, but try and describe it. And well, good luck. How can I love with all my soul if I'm not even able to clearly explain what it is? That's the question we're going to deal with today. And I will tell you right now, it's both a harder and an easier subject than you think. We need a way of understanding a spiritual subject like the soul, but in a context that is a little more earthy, which means we're going to need to take a look at two-thirds of a legendary American band. Brothers Maurice and Verdeen White, along with their friend Philip Bailey, won 7 Grammys in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Most of those awards were won in the category of R&B, or rhythm and blues. But fans and experts alike agree that they weren't really an R&B band. They had combined other genres like funk and jazz, disco, pop, Latin and African music, and yes, soul, to make a sound distinctly their own. The name of the band? Earth, Wind, and Fire. If you don't know who that band is, it may be time for you to do some soul searching. But likely you've at least heard their hit September. If you haven't heard that one, I'll wait while you go look it up. Seriously. Now that you've done that, you are educated. Yeah, that's Earth, Wind, and Fire. And for the record, their most popular song, September, includes the lyric, "Our hearts were ringing in the key that our souls were singing." So there's another example of using the word soul in a beautiful way that we all get, but none of us can explain. Now, when I said we need to look at two-thirds of Earth, Wind, and Fire, I didn't mean two-thirds of the musicians. I meant two-thirds of the name they chose. I know what Earth is. You can touch it, taste it, probably best not to, and you can feel it between your toes. It's solid, sturdy. It can be dissected down to its basic atomic elements if you need to. We can store it in bottles, flatten it with bulldozers, and buy and sell it by the acre. Earth is completely tangible. But what about wind and fire? Everybody knows what wind is, and we all agree that fire exists, but scientifically, what are they? You can't bottle them or hold them. You can't even see wind. Fire is ephemeral at best, and it can't be quantified. Wind and fire are neither solid, liquid, gas, or plasma. They are intangible, yet unarguably real. They are the sort of thing that exists without substance. And in science, we have to use a different word for them. We call them phenomena. A phenomenon is an observable event or occurrence in the natural world. The word comes from a Greek root, which means to appear or to show. In science and in philosophy, phenomenon are those aspects of the world that can be observed or experienced either through direct perception or use of some instrument. You may not be able to bottle the wind or quantify the substance of a flame or find the end of a rainbow, but they definitely exist. And you know it because you've experienced them. You've felt the wind upon your face, been burnt by fire, and stood in awe of the beauty of a rainbow. All of these phenomena are real. And just because they're intangible doesn't make them any less real. These phenomena are a good way to understand the soul. And do you know how I know that? It's because Jesus explained the soul using those examples. In a conversation with Nicodemus, Jesus is asked to explain the rebirth of the soul that happens at baptism. Nicodemus said to him, "How can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born?" And Jesus answered, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who's born of the Spirit." In addition to this, when describing the Holy Spirit, the book of Revelation uses a symbolism of fire to give us an image of the Spirit as seven torches that are ever burning before the throne of God. Even the Hebrew word for the soul, nefesh, comes from the idea of life, which is definitely a real thing, but hard to quantify. What's the difference between a living body and a dead one? All the same parts are there, but one has no life. Because it turns out that a living human is more than just a combination of bones and skin and muscle and organ. James, in his letter to the church, even goes so far as to say, the closest you'll ever get to understanding the importance of the soul is found in the process of death. His words? "For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead." James 2:26. When the soul leaves the body, life is gone. Life is a phenomenon that science has a really hard time quantifying. But it would be ridiculous to say life isn't real just because we can't seem to put it into a neat little box. Okay, so forget about wind, fire, rainbows, and life for a second. Here's what I need you to know. Even in the natural world, there are things that exist that we can't tangibly grasp, weigh, or quantify. How much more must that be true in the spiritual realm? Because after all, the spiritual realm is the great unknown, the uncharted territory of the human experience. Even the words in the Bible used to describe the spiritual realm, Sheol and Hades, well, they mean the asking place and the unknown place. We ask and we wonder what the spiritual realm is, but at least on this side of eternity, the details remain unknown. What the soul looks like is just as difficult of a question as what heaven will look like or what the angels sound like. But what your soul looks like isn't the important part anyways. What is important is the way that you use it. Imagine for a second that you had been born blind. You wouldn't know what your body looked like, but you would still learn to use it properly. Souls are for using, and if we're going to love the Lord and our neighbor with our whole soul, we better figure out how to use them properly. And to understand what that means, we need to travel in our mind's eye to the barren wastelands of the Sinai Peninsula. Standing before a Jewish nation that barely knew what it meant to be a nation, Moses recounted to them the series of events that had led them out of hundreds of years of Egyptian bondage. Generations of slaves now stood as free men and women at the cusp of a bright new era of liberty. Moses was to lead them into the promised land. After all, God had already crippled their Egyptian overlords with 10 devastating plagues, parted the depths of the Red Sea, led them through on dry ground, and fed them with bread that miraculously appeared each morning like dew upon the ground. These people had seen the seas crash back down on Pharaoh's army, had tasted the manna from heaven, and drank the sweet waters of God that had poured forth from the rocks of the desert. So what does Moses say to this fledgling nation as they step toward the promised land? In Deuteronomy 4, he tells them, "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? Only take care and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life." You see, Moses understood what we must learn. You have a body, but you are a soul, and you are your soul's keeper. It didn't matter what they had achieved, or how far they had come, or what their external world looked like, if the Israelites didn't master their own souls. You are your soul's keeper. The most important thing in your life is not what you do, but who you become. If the Israelites thought of themselves as slaves, longed for Egyptian luxuries, and failed to become faithful conquerors, it didn't matter where they pitched their tent at night. Your soul is the one thing you take with you. A corrupt soul, a cowardly soul, a depraved soul, they will not be repaired with more money or better living conditions. And if your soul's healthy, no external circumstance can destroy your life. If your soul is unhealthy, no external circumstance can redeem your life. Jesus alludes to this idea when he says, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?" There is no external reward that can serve as a replacement for a healthy internal soul. Your soul is you. It is the one thing you will carry with you into your eternal destiny. Perhaps that is what Jesus is pointing toward when he tells us to store up treasures for ourselves in heaven. Invest in your soul, and you can take it with you. Invest in this life only, and moth and rust will destroy, and thieves will break in and steal. Your soul isn't just the part of you that lives on after death. It is the most important part of you now, too. It is you, and in a very real sense, it is your moral compass. Your human soul isn't meant to be controlled by instinct like wild beasts, where desire, appetite, lust, and other base fleshly emotions drive behavior. Your soul is meant to be elevated to higher ethical planes. Your soul is designed by God to love like God. Love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, these things emanate from the soul that is fed upon the Spirit of God. Ask yourself, if my soul were unhindered by the boundaries of my circumstances, if my earthly body didn't constrain my influence, would I do good or evil with that freedom? If I had the resources, would I make the world a better place or bask in selfish amusement? If I had the power to change the world, would I rule with an iron fist or do good to all men? The answers to these questions all focus on your soul. Your soul is who you are when everything else slips away. When Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, tried to stay awake and stand watch. But eventually their fatigue and sorrow got the better of them, and so they fell asleep. Jesus told them, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Jesus recognized that they wanted to do the right thing, but their strength had failed. For many others, it's the exact opposite. They have the strength to do good, but their spirit isn't willing. Power is nothing without a willing soul. So here's what you need to know. If you want to love better from the soul, you're going to have to invest in your soul. Because even though you can't see it, you know that it is there. Long after your body is in a pine box 6 feet under, your soul will live on. In this episode, we've touched on a whole variety of topics surrounding the soul. But in the weeks ahead, we're going to get into the details. From soulmates to soul searching to dark souls, we'll look at all of it. I'm excited, and I hope you are too. So let's learn to love better. Learn to love with all your soul. If you've listened this far, hopefully we've done something to help make your life a little bit better. Would you mind returning the favor and helping us by subscribing to the podcast through your favorite platform, by sharing with others, or leaving a review on Apple Podcast or Spotify? You help us reach more people. Also, if you want more information about the work I'm doing at Eastland, visit us at eastlandchristians.org or my personal Bible site, biblegrad.com, where you can sign up for daily Bible devotionals called Bible Bites and receive them in your email each morning. Take online Bible classes or find videos that will help you study through the Bible throughout the year. And until next time, remember, you are loved. So go love better.